Welcome, members and guests, to the March 28th program of the City Club of Eugene. Welcome to our TV audiences on community television and the Oregon Wind Network. I'm Marty Wilde, the City Club president. Our sponsors today are Oregon Country Fair, Helios Resource Network, Dot Dotsons, and a special thank you to KLCC for airing the programs on Monday night, and KPFF Consulting Engineers for our office space. We thank you for listening. These programs are free for our listening audience, yet there are costs involved. Your contribution is completely tax deductible and will help keep our organization healthy. Today's presenter is Steve McQuitty, who will discuss the topic of World War II conscientious objectors on the Oregon coast, Seeds of the 60s. Our program organizer is Marlene Nasseri, and here's program committee member Rob Zako to introduce Mr. McQuitty.
Thank you, Steve. Welcome, everyone. Thank you, Marty. Introducing Steve. Welcome, everyone. So Steve McQuitty is a friend of mine. I'm going to introduce him. I'm honored to do so. He writes and lectures on Pacific Northwest history and culture, particularly the eccentric quarter. He has written for Salon, Mother Jones, Seattle Times, and Best Essays Northwest. He's been awarded by the Society of Professional Journalists. He's an honorary director of the Oregon Cultural Heritage Commission and is a member or has been a member of the Lane County Historical Society. He teaches writing at Lane Community College. Basically, as I understand it, Steve likes to tell stories. And if there's a quirky local story, there's a good chance that Steve's had a role to play in that. If you know of Opal Whiteley down in Cottage Grove, Steve's told that story. Masonic Cemetery, where Eugene Skinner's buried, and a bunch of other people, he had a hand in writing Full of Life, or editing Full of Life, stories about a lot of the founding people here in Eugene. If you have questions about Civic Stadium and what we might want to do with it, he knows the history of that. And he had a hand in the City Club's publication, Eugene 1945 to 2000. As I said, Steve's a personal friend of mine, and I've known him not quite for 20 years. I'm told that he started work on this book 20 years ago, at least as an idea. I think my memory more is that for the last 6 or 7 years, when a bunch of us would get together, Steve was never available because he was always down in Berkeley at the archives in some musty place looking at these old papers, researching. We weren't really quite sure what the heck he was doing for those 6 years. We never saw him. His wife didn't see him. But he started researching this place on the coast in Walport, this conscientious objectors camp. And it's an interesting story, but I think it's even more interesting in what he found that he didn't expect to find of how that connected to our broader culture. So I'm very happy to introduce my friend and our speaker today, Steve McQuitty. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob. And yeah, he pretty much got it right. I disappeared for about 6 years. And Rob and some of our other friends were very patient in trying to bring me out on occasion. The title of the book that I wrote about this story is called Here on the Edge. And I love that title. It's one of my favorite titles. And I can say that without modesty because I didn't make it up. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that shortly. And first, I do need to make a couple of things clear. I am not a conscientious objector. I was a couple years too young to be drafted for Vietnam and a couple decades too old for the 21st century wars. I'm not a peace activist. I'm not a specialist in conscientious objection. I am merely a writer who recognizes a good story when he sees one. And when I first encountered this one about 20 years ago, I was amazed that it hadn't already been written. I first thought I was just going to write a magazine article. But as I discovered this episode or that detail, it kept growing and growing. And months went by, and then years, and I had to set it aside now and again. But I kept coming back to it. And eventually, what emerged was a story so complex, so complicated, so full of contradictions and dead ends that when I finally was able to sit down and actually write the story out about 6 years ago, I quickly understood why it hadn't been done before. What if I told you that much of the revolutionary movements we associate with the 1960s and 70s, peace, love, equal rights for all races and genders, environmentalism, public and personal health based on diet and lifestyle choices, avant-garde work in writing, music, and art, democratic decision-making based on collaboration and mutual respect. What if I told you that all of these things existed in a small, isolated work camp for conscientious objectors on the Oregon coast during World War II? I'm telling you now, they did. The place was called Civilian Conservation Corps Camp Number 56, also known as Camp Angel with two L's, Camp Angel with one L, and also Camp Waldport. It was located 4 miles south of Waldport, 2 miles north of Yahats on the central Oregon coast, as most of us know, and just off Highway 101 and a few hundred yards from the ocean. And the effects of what happened in that camp, the ideas and actions incubated there, resonated far beyond its borders, far beyond its time. As I mentioned, it was 20 years ago. It began with a photograph I saw in the University of Oregon archives. It was a small black and white photo of a crazy man, or at least he looked crazy to me. He had wild shoulder-length hair, matted and tangled like unintentional dreadlocks. I've got a picture of this in the book if anybody wants to see it. And his beard reached almost to his chest, and it bristled out like an overused whisk broom. He wore a beat-up old jacket and looked past the camera with a faraway stare, as if he either was in a daze or maybe he saw something the rest of us didn't. Well, he was a poet, and I was looking at a picture that was published in his book. I did some research and found out that he was a champion basketball player in college. He walked 300 miles to his wartime assignment camp. He wrote hundreds of books of poetry, single-handedly founded a folk art school for adults based on the philosophy of the 19th century Danish educator Nikolai Grundtvig. And he built a house that looked like Dr. Seuss or something out of Dr. Seuss. He built a house there about 30 miles east of Portland in the foothills. And he went to graduate school at the University of Oregon in 1960 at the age of 45. His name was Glenn Caulfield, and he was so unique, so far ahead of his time that none of us have ever heard of him. William Everson was a little better known. He was a tall, serious-minded poet from California's San Joaquin Valley. He thought he would be a farmer, but he ended up in Berkeley after the war. He self-published books of his poetry. He became a monk for 18 years, and in 1969 took off his robes and resigned his vows and married a woman 30 years his junior. And he eventually became the master printer at the University of California at Santa Cruz. Kermit Sheets was another character there, and he worked for a time as a drama instructor, but really he was a lover. He loved women, he loved men, he loved art and music and theater, and he loved life. After the war, he went to San Francisco and founded the Interplayers Theater Company. He also founded the Centaur Press, and he became involved in experimental films, and he actually was part of a film that won an award in the early 1950s at the Cannes Film Festival. Adrian Wilson, he wanted to write books, but he ended up printing some of the most beautiful books ever made. For 3 decades, from his studio in San Francisco, he printed fine books for private collectors and also the Limited Editions Club. And his text on bookmaking, titled The Design of Books, is considered one of the classics in the field. And he was one of the very earliest recipients of the MacArthur Genius Grants in 1983. Kemper Nomlin was an architect, and he liked to draw and paint and design things as well. And he painted portraits of his colleagues, and he illustrated books. And in one documented case, in 1943, he made a simple line drawing for a mimeographed magazine, and it was declared obscene by the Postal Service and Cascade Locks on the Columbia River east of Portland, and all copies of that magazine were destroyed. And he later became a prize-winning architect in Southern California. There were women, too. One of them was Manch Langley. While technically not a conscientious objector, she was definitely against war. She grew up in Portland in the 1920s, and she saw photos of the soldiers returned from World War I, and she saw what had happened to them both physically and emotionally, how damaged they were. And she said she could never, ever support a war. And during the war, during World War II, she worked at various conscientious objectors camps in some kind of administrative or secretarial work, really anywhere a woman was allowed to contribute at the time. So these people I mentioned, and about 100 others at any given time, were all at Camp Number 56. And this was one of 150 work camps set up across the country from 1941 to 1946, where conscientious objectors could do work for the country in lieu of military service. And as part of the Selective Training and Service Act passed by Congress in 1940, Civilian Public Service, or CPS as it was called, was a place where people could do work of, quote, national importance, and this would be determined by an interagency government board pending approval by the president. So out of the roughly 50,000 conscientious objectors in World War II, about half of them served in some kind of non-combatant role or were otherwise excused, and about 12,000 went to work in CPS. Some tended patients in mental hospitals, and others volunteered as guinea pigs in medical experiments. Yes, we had them in this country, and a number of them were not very pretty. And the large majority, though, were sent to CPS, and they were sent to these rural camps where they did work very similar to the Civilian Conservation Corps, which I'm sure many of us recognize as the New Deal program for young people to do work across the country set up by Franklin Roosevelt's administration. Well, many of the camps people were sent to were, in fact, Civilian Conservation Corps camps, and they were there ready and waiting for the conscientious objectors. Now, how CPS worked, it was a very complex public-private partnership. The camp spaces and equipment were provided by the U.S. government, and the camp funding and administration were provided by what were called the three historic peace churches. These were the Friends, often known as the Quakers, the Mennonites, and the Brethren, known as the peace churches for their long-standing opposition to war. And the idea, in fact, came from leaders of the peace churches, and they approached Roosevelt as the war was looming, and they suggested that the conscientious objectors could be more productive if they were not simply sent to prison, as had often been the case in the past. So what would they do? The COs would generally work about 8 1/2 hour days, 6 days a week, with no pay. No pay except a $2.50 a month allowance for things like toothpaste and soap. Their holidays were Sundays and Christmas Day, and their conscription would last the duration of the war plus 6 months. Now, depending on a camp's location in the country, the work might be in forestry, soil conservation, agriculture, dairy, fish and wildlife management. They even did weather research. Camp 56, on Oregon's central coastline in the heart of logging country, naturally focused on tree planting. And for those of you who are familiar with the central coast, this is the site, Camp Angel with two L's. It is there today, and it is the site of the current Angel Northwest Job Corps, where young people are getting an education and doing work to set themselves up for their future. And actually, I was just there yesterday, spoke to a packed gymnasium full of the young people. It was inspiring. They came up with so many questions. So in the daylight hours, the people at the camp, they work 6 days a week, right? For no pay, remember, just room and board. They chopped wood, they crushed rock, they cut trails, they fought forest fires and during the dry season, and mostly they spent their time planting trees. And for a number of the campers, as they were called, this was okay. Many of them were strong religious conservatives. They belonged to strict churches whose teachings often took the Bible literally. And they were content to do their work, study their Bible lessons, and put in their time until they returned to their farms and their quiet lives. Well, some of the men in the camps didn't quite have that idea. They weren't satisfied to just dig ditches or plant trees. They may have come from not such a strict religious background. They were more of a political or philosophical objector. And so to answer some of these desires, the camps, again, they were administered by the peace churches, okay, not the U.S. government. And so to answer this desire, some of the camps set up activities beyond the daily labor, and they organized programs which they called schools, and they addressed a particular topic or discipline. One focused on health, another on education, another on politics. Now, the camp in Waldport, by fate or chance or something else, take your pick, ended up with a concentration of rather creative-minded individuals. And they'd put in their 50-plus hours planting trees or crushing rock, and then spend their nights writing, drawing, and printing up their work on a beat-up mimeograph machine in the camp office. They put out a weekly newsletter called The Untied, U-N-T-I-D-E. And this was a play on the official camp newsletter called The Tide, which they considered too stodgy and safe. And they filled it with humor and puns and cartoons, and they had a motto underneath each issue that said, "What is not tied is untied." So this began as a lighthearted protest, but it quickly grew into a serious artistic venture. William Everson, whom I mentioned earlier, he was already a published poet before the war, and he printed a series of poems that they inserted into each of the issues of The Untied. And they were these what he called 10 war elegies. And they were eventually made into a booklet that they just stapled together and distributed throughout the CPS system. And he quickly became regarded as the premier pacifist voice, the premier voice in the country for pacifist poetry. Well, they grew into an officially sanctioned program. They called it the Fine Arts Group. And this was a center of activity for artists, actors, musicians, and writers who chose to take a condition of penance and put it to creative ends. Now, their focus was not so much on the current war, but on what kind of society might be possible when the shooting finally stopped. And this is a quote from what they wrote. "Here on the edge. Here on the edge, we can only watch and prepare, and bide on the time when what we are and that for which we have taken this stand can be tangent again to the world." And that's where I got the title of my book. And it was written by William Everson. It was published in The Untied. Now, they knew they weren't speaking to the current generation, but even they, who were deciding that they were needed to do something at the time, even they could have no idea how far and wide and deeply what they were doing was going to resonate beyond the borders of this camp. Well, they found an old letterpress printer at a secondhand shop in Waldport, believe it or not. They hauled it back to the camp, they cleaned it up, and began publishing books under the imprint of the Untied Press. And the Fine Arts Group reputation spread across CPS, and other COs transferred to Waldport. They launched a theater group, which included two members of the highly respected Hedgerow Theater, originally founded outside of Philadelphia in the 1920s. They put on plays by authors such as Edna St. Vincent Millay, Henrik Ibsen, George Bernard Shaw, and Anton Chekhov. And these were really cutting-edge plays at the time. And they also featured chamber music, and they put together a string quartet featuring Broadus Earl on violin. Some of you may recognize him. He really made quite a name for himself as a founder of the New Music Quartet and played in the Tokyo Symphony and others, and eventually became a professor at Yale University. And also a local guy, Warren Downs from Salem, Oregon, and he played the cello, and he went on to make quite a name for himself in various symphonies. And, well, at times they only had three string players for the quartet. And the fellow I mentioned earlier, Adrian Wilson, who became a very well-known fine printer, he was actually a very accomplished clarinetist, and he would play one of the string parts on his woodwind. Now, let's not forget, they were doing all of this after working 50-plus hours each week, often out in the muck and the rain, planting trees over hills that had been logged and burned into a jumbled mass. Now, I know these people are not household names. Here's a few names you might recognize. Morris Graves, who earned fame as one of the Pacific Northwest mystic painters. He spent a month at Waldport as a visiting artist. Well, he wasn't actually at Waldport. If you're familiar with Morris Graves' eccentric character, he came down in a Model T from the Puget Sound territory, and he set up a lean-to about a mile north of the camp at a place called Big Creek, where it met the sand and the ocean. He built a lean-to. He built a bed out of moss, and for companionship, he had three dachshunds. And he would lay his canvases out on the ground and lean over them to paint, and he said that freed up the motion of his arm. And they actually held an exhibit of his paintings at the Waldport camp in 1945. And they had the paintings up on the wall for sale. They were selling for about $10 to $20. Okay, and so you recognize about 3 years later, they were selling in the tens of thousands after he got noticed by New York. There was another young CO at a camp in Southern California at the time, William Stafford. And he sent the people up in Waldport some stories and poems, completely unknown. And they decided to go ahead and publish some of his work. And in fact, Glenn Caulfield, the unshaven poet I mentioned earlier with the crazy hair, I actually found a postcard that he wrote at the time. And he said, it would be good to publish a book by this guy Stafford. And I quote him. He says, I do not think there is much question that Stafford's work would hold up. And I wonder if maybe this isn't the first written review of Stafford's work ever. Okay. How many of you have ever heard of Henry Miller, the author? Yeah. Tropic of Cancer, Tropic of Capricorn, Black Spring. His books were banned for 30 years in this country because they were so, he dealt honestly with, sex, among other things. Well, William Everson knew Henry Miller before the war. And when the Fine Arts Group began, he wrote to Miller, who was living down in Big Sur, and he asked him if he would come up and be the director of the Fine Arts Group. And Miller politely declined. He was busy down in Big Sur writing his books, and he wrote a letter, and I quote him here. He said, well, I don't do so good in groups. And then he said, I would soon prove to be a thorn in everyone's side. But I love to imagine what would have happened if Henry Miller had come up to Waldport, and what if he had liked it, and what if he had stayed? Then think about what happened in the 60s with all these young literary pilgrims streaming out of San Francisco to go visit the guru Henry Miller, but not going to Big Sur, coming up to Waldport. Think about how that would have changed the whole dynamic of the Eugene Bay Area connection. How about Kenneth Patchen? Kenneth Patchen was a fiery anti-war poet, and he was pretty popular in New York at the time. And he sent them some of his poems, and this gives you an idea of Patchen's mentality. He says, here's my poems. These are all my anti-war poems. I want you to publish them in a booklet, but you can only do it if any profits go back into your operation so you can publish more anti-war poetry. So here's an author saying, I don't want any money. I want you to keep this going. And Patchen, so they put together one of his booklets. And it was an interesting design. And it had a black cover and this wraparound white block that covered the staples and made a smaller square on the front. And the title was printed in the white block. It was really quite stark, really ahead of its time. And I'll explain more about that very shortly. Well, after the war, a number of the camp members went to San Francisco, where they got involved in theater, music, art, and other creative work. Kermit Sheets, Adrian Wilson, and others founded the Interplayers Theater, as I mentioned earlier. And this really helped pave the way for other independent repertory theater groups in San Francisco. Some of the fine arts members, notably William Everson, influenced the growing activities in spoken word performance. This is in the late 40s, early 50s, and this is driven by such figures as Kenneth Rexroth, Robert Duncan. And this contributed to what became known as the San Francisco Poetry Renaissance of the 1950s, which brought us such icons as Lawrence Ferlinghetti's City Lights Bookstore, and he was an important promoter of the Beat Generation writer Jack Kerouac, author of On the Road, Allen Ginsberg, author of the long poem Howl. And if any of you have seen the cover of Howl with its stark white-on-black block design, then you have seen the original design from Kenneth Patchen's book, An Astonished Eye Looks Out of the Air, published in 1945 in Waldport. This is what became the iconic pocket poet's design for all the City Lights books, pocket poets, with that block, the one block color on another. This was actually done at Waldport in 1945. And I actually spoke to Lawrence Ferlinghetti. He's 95 years old, still living in San Francisco. And he told me that in the early 50s, when he was thinking of publishing books, that Kenneth Patchen gave him a copy of his book published by the Untied Press. And he liked it so much, he simply took the design and made that the design for his pocket poet series. Well, All of this activity in San Francisco inspired a young author from Springfield, Oregon, Ken Kesey, who, as a graduate student at Stanford University, participated in government experiments with LSD, wrote a best-selling book entitled One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, then gathered together a group called the Merry Pranksters, who drove a psychedelic painted bus and hosted creative happenings known as the acid tests, where people drank Kool-Aid laced with LSD and listened to the music of a band that would come to be known as, oh, what was their name? Ah, the Grateful Dead, yeah. Which, of course, led the way to the 1960s creative and cultural explosions epitomized by San Francisco's 1967 Summer of Love. Now, I'm not saying the Summer of Love began at a conscientious objectors camp in Walport in 1945. But you know, there is a deep current running here. Not only were members of the fine arts group in Camp 56 engaged in creative acts far ahead of their time, they were also plowing ground for the next generation when a new set of young people, faced with a war of their own in Vietnam, would populate the massive peace movements of the 1960s. Most of us are probably familiar with John Lennon's famous song, Give Peace a Chance, which was popularized when he and Yoko Ono spent a week in a Montreal hotel room, and they were playing music and urging people to take the nonviolent path in protest. And Lennon interviewed at the time, and I quote him here, he said, "Grow your hair for peace and stay in bed for peace. Do something like that that can't be got, can't be smashed." Well, that brings us back to one of the first names I mentioned, Glenn Caulfield, the anarchist with the wild hair and crazy beard who scribbled his poems and dreamed of a world that others couldn't yet see. I did my research. He wasn't crazy. He wasn't an unwashed lunatic. At a conscientious objectors camp in 1944 on the Central Oregon coast, for an entire year, he refused to cut his hair or shave as a protest. He was growing his hair for peace. This is where the deeper story lies. When a group of men and women, during what could be termed the most popular war in American history, chose to reject war, the very idea of war, and direct their efforts toward creative rather than destructive ends. It is true that the problems of war and peace are complex. A case for one can easily be negated by the exigencies of the other. And any responsible dialogue requires a willingness to question our assumptions about the role war and peace play in our society. In all my research for this story, I did not find anyone saying the United States should have ignored Hitler's atrocities or the attack at Pearl Harbor. Instead, they spoke of a longer view, an approach to living that might possibly obviate the need for killing in the name of one nation over another. And they expressed it through art, music, theater, and writing. This might be called unrealistic by some, and I will admit that I have found no concrete formula to make it happen. But I also found evidence, plenty of evidence, that during the dark days of the 1940s, as the civilized world was engulfed in a horrific, horrendous orgy of killing, there was a minority of people who believed in their ideal so strongly that they acted on it and willingly paid the consequences. And what was their ideal? So unpopular that they were sent to remote work camps hidden away from the public eye. Peace. The very ideal we claim for ourselves as a nation. The difference was that they believed it truly was possible to not only imagine, but to build that world of freedom, decency, and peace, of which we speak so much, but as yet remains a dream. Thank you.
Oh, go ahead. I was asked to ask the first question. I guess I'm 20 years in the military, so maybe that's it. So I thought reasons people join the military, reasons of conscience, economy, camaraderie, and a desire to work with others for the good of the community or the good of the country. Obviously, the conscientious objectors you spoke with served for reasons of conscience, and well, because they were required to. Did you get the same sense of camaraderie and working towards a better future? In your talk, I noticed they came together because they were forced to, but also because they desired to, and then they seemed to separate and go their own ways, dandelion seeds, perhaps,
sure.
And then coalesce at different places and different mm-hmm. times. Did you get the sense as you were researching it, though, that they had that sense of being part of a larger community in their service?
Right. I actually asked that question point blank to a number of people. And some did, but really the minority. Most of them were simply doing what they felt was true to their conscience. And as I mentioned earlier, the vast majority of the COs in World War II were members of the three historic peace churches. And they came from really quite, strong, very strict religious backgrounds. And, they simply put in their time and they were ready to go back. There were some who were, as I said, politically minded and more philosophically averse to the war. They did feel that they had to do something. And a number of them both wrote at the time and told me. I did get to interview about six or seven people, some before they passed on and some who are still alive today. And they did feel that they had to do something, and they didn't know what. But they felt that maybe if we can somehow create a voice, a place, a medium through which these ideas and ideals can be articulated, that maybe that record can survive and maybe that can pass on. Now, they didn't foresee the baby boom. They didn't know that there would be an entire generation that would essentially plug into what they were talking about. And a number of them expressed to me personally, really, just outright surprise. They said, we had no idea. We had no idea what was going on. But an interesting corollary to that is CPS did not continue after World War II. There wasn't a CPS during the Korean War, and as many of you probably know, Vietnam either, for a variety of reasons. One was that it was pretty expensive for the peace churches. Their members paid for it. Their members paid for, to keep these camps going. And but also a number of people commented. They said that they realized later on that maybe some of the powers that be recognized, wait a second, we put all these people together. And maybe we don't want to have them all stuck together in the future. That was one slightly irreverent comment that I heard.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Steve McGuitty. And we will now take a break for you to compose your own questions at the table. We'll take about 5 minutes, compose your questions, then come up and ask them. Thank you.
You're tuned to KLCC Eugene 89.7 FM, KLCO Newport 90.5, 89.1 KLFR Reedsport, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. We're also on the web at klcc.org.
And to your questions.
Hi, Matt Dodd, City Club member. My table was wondering, what were the interactions like with the camp members in the local community? How did they get along and interact?
Right. And it of course, was not that black and white. it was pretty complex. Generally, I would say it was what you would expect with almost any group. The majority of people, pretty much tolerated them. You might run, some people were vehemently against them. And some people were, quite strong supporters. I spent some time in the book talking about the local newspaper editor in Waldport. They had weekly newspapers at the time in the small towns, and he was strongly against them. And he would write scathing editorials castigating what he called the conchies. That was actually a pejorative term at the time. And the people down at the conchie camp. And there's a hilarious episode, I'll say very briefly. It was New Year's Eve, and there was a party, a dance down at the local roadhouse, right? That they had actually roadhouses back then, which is the space out in the building outside of town where everybody could go and entertain the debauchery. And they were dancing. Some of the guys there, a number of people had their wives there. And their wives lived in the tourist cottages across the highway. And so they were down there at Capps Roadhouse, dancing, and they started jitterbugging. And so the editor got so upset that he wrote this scathing editorial about the conscientious jitterbuggers. And he had an idiosyncratic writing style, which was full of misspellings and misplaced exclamation marks and things like that. So a lot of the local people didn't take him seriously. And as I dug down into the details, I actually found a lot of these details in the National Archives for the Forest Service up in Seattle, the records there. And it turns out that one of the people said that maybe what the editor was upset about was that his sister was dancing with one of those conscientious objectors. And so, but really, to answer the question specifically, it ran the spectrum. It was your normal bell curve, where the large majority of people were, you know, pretty much tolerated them. Yeah.
I'm Jane Smith, City Club member. I'm interested in what appears to be a conflict of authority and values bases. For example, if some of them were the victims of medical testing. The other population that we used in former times, I hope it was former times, were felons, incarcerated people. So these were definitely incarcerated people in some sense. They'd broken the law. And then you have a benign administrative influence, and I don't know, was there a military representative and someone from one of the churches. And then you have a mixed population of people, I would gather, with a conservative sense of who they were and obeyed a different authority. And then you had these freewheeling, imaginative, creative people. And how did they handle that dynamic within the group? Was the group a cohesive group? So you get the picture.
Right, right. So if I understand, the question which you're asking is how did they interact within the camp itself? And that too.
And how much freedom and from the military standpoint.
Right.
And then freedom to move about.
Sure, sure. Okay, that's in two parts, and I'll do answer as succinctly as I can. First, I'll address what you said about freedom. How could they move about? All right, so this was not a military camp. What happened is the Selective Service, through the local draft boards, would determine who would go to CPS, and that was it. And then they were sent to CPS, and one of the historic peace churches would administrate and oversee the operation of the camp itself. The camp at Waldport was run by the Brethren Church. And what they decided to do was they actually created a constitution. They had a workers' committee. They had a variety of governance committees that would oversee the operation of the camp. And so this was truly a democratic shared governance system. There was a director appointed by the Brethren Church, but he largely kind of just sort of helped facilitate things. He knew better than to actually say, this is going to happen, this is going to happen. Now, this was actually relatively unique for CPS camps. Some of the more strict churches, the Mennonite Church, for example, was quite strict. And they had a lot of people from just their church. And so they would dictate and say, you do this, you do that. So within that system, then as far as how they could come and go, they were given furloughs, just like in the military. However, the only days off they had were Sundays and Christmas Day. Other than that, they had the equivalent furlough time that a member of the military might have. How they operated within the camp was a result of how those governance committees worked, along with your normal natural social selection. The people of like minds tended to congregate together. And there's a marvelous example. The fine arts group, who tended to be somewhat irreligious, they had pretty liberal views, they actually got along with one of the more strict church groups. The Jehovah's Witnesses. The Jehovah's Witnesses actually had a very tolerant viewpoint towards the fine arts group, and they shared a dorm. And the Jehovah's Witnesses, for those of you who may not know this, and I hope I'm saying this correctly, I'll keep it very, very general and brief. It's my understanding through my research that Jehovah's Witnesses were not pacifists. They were against the war because they believe only in one war, and that is the War of Armageddon, the End Days War. And they said they would fight, they would swear, they would smoke, they would drink if they could, and but they would not take part in the war. So they ended up sharing a dorm with the fine arts group. And so you would have the fine arts group on one side, okay, with their jazz records, you know, and their art and all that kind of stuff. And then the Jehovah's Witnesses, who a lot of them came from Eastern Oregon. They were kind of these cowboys, right? And they were there, and they'd be swearing and playing cards and doing all their stuff and debating the Bible, right? And they actually coexisted quite well in that dorm.
And I'm John Anik, a City Club member. I'm pinch hitting for somebody at our table. The question: during the Vietnam War, conscientious objectors had to produce evidence that they had these anti-war feelings before the war began. How does this requirement, this later requirement, relate to the experiences of this camp and others during World War II?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. I actually, I'm confident that the majority of people in this room know more about the details of the Vietnam War than I do. I was a young man at the time, but not old enough for draft age. In my research, what I was able to determine was that the effect that civilian public service had on future wars, whether it be Korea and Vietnam mostly, was that it was considered successful in many ways, in which it did provide an opportunity for citizens of our country who could not, through reasons of conscience, participate in a war. And it gave them an opportunity to actually serve their country in a constructive way. The way in which people were assigned to CPS was also quite complex, but really quite simple. Now that I think about it, it was all up to the local draft board. And they would go before their local draft board, and whoever that was, and many of them were World War I vets and people with a strong civic background, and they could be sent to prison. They could be excused completely. They could be assigned to civilian public service. And it's my understanding that what ended up happening in the later wars is that in World War II, it's my understanding that for the first time, they actually allowed conscientious objection for reasons of political, philosophical, or other categories. They actually had about 19 categories. I mentioned it in the book. I have the list in the book. It's fascinating. These categories that Selective Service came up with. And it is my understanding that that was the breakthrough. And so that when Vietnam came, when people did have to prove their conscientious objection according to the standards, that those were informed by what happened with civilian public service.
This is kind of a follow-up on the clash of cultures. You characterized at least some elements of the sponsoring churches as otherwise conservative, and yet this particular camp supported by a church, had a fairly radical group. And so I just wondered if there was any information about how the sponsoring church members felt about supporting these people in this, an interesting lifestyle to perpetuate perhaps views and values that were not consistent with the church's belief.
Right, right. Good question. And I was asking myself that very question as I was researching and interviewing and going along. How could this happen? And as near as I can determine, it happened in the way that so many of these things happen. It depended on the individuals and positions of power. And it's my, as I read the letters and listened to the interviews. I was lucky. There were a number of recorded interviews. There were two key people in the Church of the Brethren. And, you know, I don't want to make any claims about churches or belief systems. I feel that that's irresponsible, and I simply do not have the I'm in no position to do that. But I can talk, I think, about two people in the Church of the Brethren. And one of them was the director of what was called the Brethren Service Commission, or the Brethren Service Committee. And each church created this committee to handle their role with civilian public service. Harold Rau, R-O-W. And he appeared to have a liberal viewpoint of things, and he wanted not only the members of his church, but anybody who was in civilian public service under the administration of his church to have the opportunity to act in a positive and productive manner according to their conscience. And so he was specifically, personally interested in allowing these kinds of special programs and schools to happen. The other key person, and I saw many letters between him and the people I speak of in the book, Morris Keaton, K-E-E-T-O-N, himself a conscientious objector. He was the education secretary for the Brethren Service Committee. And I am convinced that it is because of the presence of those two people in the Brethren Service Committee at the time that allowed these things to happen.
Vincenzo Scarpacci, City Club member. These people came from the same region, or they came from all over the United States? Did they have an option to say, hey, I want to go to Walport, or I want to go to some other place? Right. So how did they coalesce that way?
All over the country. They came from everywhere in the country. The original rule with CPS was that when COs were assigned to a camp, they had to be at least 200 miles away because they didn't want them going home on weekends. And I believe that was relaxed a little bit later on. I don't know exactly why. As far as generally, they would go, it was just a matter of practical convenience. For example, Walport got filled up in the fall of 1942. There were a number of camps already working in the East and the Midwest. And they said, hey, look, we got fire season coming next year. We need some trees planted, and we need people available to fight fires for the following year. Let's open this camp there. And they started up a train in New York State, and it picked people up across the country who had volunteered to go west. All right. So in a way, we had sort of like this modern day wagon train heading on west. And this was, they had four cars, and they just picked them up in camps from New York State and Ohio and Indiana. And then they went down to California, and then they put them all on a bus, you know, and sent them up to Waldport. As far as the fine arts group went, once that was established, members all across the civilian public service could apply to come be a member of the fine arts group. And at any given time, the fine arts had no more than 20 or 25 people in the group. And the camp was ranging anywhere from 80 to 120 people, generally about 100 people at a time. And so they could apply to come to the group, and they could do that with the other schools as well.
Bob Hart, City Club member. Steve, a question about the uniqueness of the Walport camp. My understanding is that there were other camps that perhaps vied with Walport, like Cascades Locks. Would you care to comment on that?
Vie in what way?
Well, publications, also
yeah.
Some of the politics.
Sure. Actually, they didn't vie directly. You know, Cascade Locks is an excellent example. You know, as I mentioned earlier, there were various camps that were allowed or encouraged to open up these schools, these special study groups. And they had one in Virginia for nutrition. They had one in Pennsylvania for health. Cascade Locks was the other main camp in Oregon, and that was also run by the Brethren Service Committee. And that had some key people as well, a fellow named, can't remember his first name, Schrock, S-C-H-R-O-C-K, I believe. Really an incredible person, as I understand. And they had the School of Pacifist Living. That's what they were about. And that was their special focus. And it was all about, okay, how can we develop the idea of living as a pacifist, and how might we educate others on what that means and how that can apply to a practical life based on pacifist ideals as opposed to war-focused ideals. So they didn't vie directly with Waldport. They actually shared quite a bit. They were in contact with each other. Two key members of the fine arts group I mentioned in my talk, Kermit Sheets and Kemper Nomland, were actually at Cascade Locks in 1941 and 42. And when Waldport opened, they were loaned to come to Waldport to help set up the camp. And those two had actually started up a journal which they called the Illiterati. They loved puns. Right? They loved puns. So rather than the literati, they became the illiterati. And that was the magazine that had the obscene drawing I told you about early in my talk that Kemper drew. Yes, it was a picture of a woman. And there are pictures of it in the book. You can see them. And But the original thing has been destroyed. There are very few left, and the picture we got from the University of Oregon Archives. So to answer your question specifically, they actually shared more than vied.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ron Funke, a longtime former member of the City Club. I'm also a Quaker and a CO during the Vietnam War. My question to you, or our table's question to you, is that there's a significant number of people nowadays that are opposed to war in any form or sort. When we applied for CO status, it had to be on the basis of being a pacifist. That's not necessarily the case for everybody now. Now, if a draft was reintroduced, how do you see accommodations for these people to obtain a CO status? That's a very speculative question, I realize, but...
Yes, that is speculative. And the short answer is I haven't got a clue. But using history as our guide, I suppose, I guess I would hope that if a draft were reinstated, that the people who are setting out the guidelines and the rules for this would, first of all, recognize the incredibly complex and difficult task they have before them. I am old enough to remember Vietnam. As I said, I was just short of being drafted for it. It was very real for me. My brother was of draft age, and I still remember my father giving thanks at dinner that night when my brother's number was 263. And I saw my father cry for the first time that night. So this is, these are incredibly, if there's one thing I think I took away from this that has really changed me as a citizen of the United States, as a teacher, I teach out at LCC, and as a thinking and compassionate human being, is that this is incredibly complex. How do we address this difficult balance between the necessity of living the lives that we have chosen to support and live, the difficulties of dealing with those who disagree or somehow cannot follow the same moral and ethical ideals that we purport to share and follow. And, I got to say, coming back around, I have no idea how it might be dealt with. And I do know that it would be an incredibly complex, very difficult task. And with today's technology, with our instant social media, dear Lord, I can only imagine how it might actually play out.
I'm Terry Benge, and this is my first time here. Thanks, everybody. I wanted to ask you, I've been reading, doing all this research since I found out my mom's cousin is on the cover of the book. So I know very little about it, So
second from the left, Dick Brown.
That's right, yeah. Dick Brown. He's a boat builder. And anyway, I think he was also at Cascade Locks because I found some evidence that he wrote as part of that journal. Mm-hmm. So I was interested in that connection. But that's not what I want to ask. I read something somewhere on one of the things that I was reading about what you wrote, about your approach to writing this book, and then you said something about, I thought, that this is appears to maybe be only the beginning of the story. And so I'm wondering if you have an idea about what you're going to be doing next and where you're looking and what you meant by that.
Right. Yes, I wrote that on somewhere. I can't recall. It's online somewhere. Yeah. And this clearly is just the beginning. The book was published in October of last year. And since that time, I have heard from no less, you're just the latest to have told me, oh, I know a person on the cover. I know so-and-so. I was showing, I have a slideshow I often give, and there's a picture of a guy chopping wood, and he's this big, buff guy with these giant arms, and he's got his axe held up, and he's swinging it down. And I was giving a talk in Portland last month, and I hear this voice call out from the dark auditorium, that's my grandfather! and so this has been going on. I've been hearing from people all over the country. I've been hearing from people who were in the camp who I didn't know were still alive. I've been hearing from family members and people who knew them. I was just out at Camp Angel yesterday talking to the students who are out there at the Northwest Job Corps. And a fellow told me, oh yeah, two guys stuck around after the war and I knew them personally. So this is all going on. What we hope to do, I do, you know, on my website, hereontheedge.com, I was so excited when I decided on the title, I ran and checked it out. No one had registered hereontheedge.com. So I got that. So what I hope to do is to continually, keep adding stories on the website. Photos, items that we can add on there, and see how the story just expands. And as a former journalist, I can tell you this is a story that has what we call it has legs, right? When we say a story has legs, that means it's not set on a certain time. You know, this story is going to keep growing. It's just going to keep going on. I am confident that I'll be giving talks like this 3, 4, 5 years from now to various places. As long as somebody hasn't heard about it and is interested in the ideas of freedom, peace, decency, and how we reconcile the challenges of the individual and society, this story is going to be relevant. And I look forward to hearing stories from people. I look forward to any information. You can reach me through the website. And I see it it's just going to keep going. And Oregon State University Press are fantastic. This book's not going out of print.
John Seeler, City Club member. What, how do they, or did they, and it, how do they reconcile their ideas with self-defense? And speaking of World War II, there's significant evidence that if Hitler had his way, he would have ended up attacking the United States and killing as many people as mm-hmm. As he could. Where do they draw a line and where? Similarly. What about watching other people be killed, such as in the extermination camps? If we hadn't entered the war, it would have gone on much longer, and there would have been many more killings. How do they reconcile that, or do they?
Right. Yeah, that's an excellent question, one that I was asking from the very beginning myself. And when I talked to various people when I was doing the interviews, they would say that, the classic story, well, what if the person right in front of you has just murdered your mother and is raping your sister? What are you going to do? You know, those kinds of questions. And having not experienced that type of questioning myself, and again, as I said in the beginning, I'm not a conscientious objector. And I actually have written if I had been of age, I probably would have gone. I wouldn't have been happy about it, but I probably would have gone. How would I, do it now? I don't know. But anyways, these are very, very difficult questions, and their view in general, and I talk about this quite a bit in the book, it's not so much a matter of how do we respond to those things, but how do we go about creating a society in which it's possible that those things won't happen? And, you know, is that realistic? I don't know. You know, I don't know. And many of them don't have answers either. But that seemed to be their general view.
Well, thank you to Steve McQuitty, author of Here on the Edge, for bringing clarity and vision to the City Club program on World War II, Conscientious Objectors on the Oregon Coast, The Seeds of the 60s.
Thank you.
Thanks again to our sponsors, the Oregon Country Fair, Helios Resource Network, and Dot Dotson's. We meet again next Friday on April 4th at the Downtown Athletic Club to hear Working Together on Best Outcomes for Kids. Hopefully it won't snow again. Lunches for this program can be ordered on the City Club's website or by contacting the office.